So the third page is an infomercial. It's my specialty is John Newton, and so most of my books are related to him, like that. So the first one is Wise Counsel. These are 83 letters that he wrote to one person. Most of those were never published before. I'm getting good reviews on that. Somebody wrote me just last week and said he's reading him is like having my own mentor. So that's what it is. And the second book is a great blessing to me. It's somewhat related to what I'm going to be presenting here today, because John Newton grew up sort of independent of any kind of denominational connections, theological connections. He was he attended the Anglican Church, but he wasn't aware of what was going on in the Great Awakening, Evangelical Revival. He was unaware of all those little nuances of ideas. And so let me give you... Oh, I should. I guess this is the... They always talk about disclaimers, or not a disclaimer. But anyway, you have to give full knowledge of who you are before you... so you're, you know, oh, he's biased. No wonder he liked that person, right? You're, of course, aware that Methodism in its earlier days was fairly united. Came out of Oxford with the Methodist that movement, but then it did divide, and it divided. You had the Arminian, the Wesleyan side, John and Charles, others on that side. That's your side, and then on the other side, the other branch was George Whitefield, Lady Huntington, and Howell Harris. Howell Harris was the great Welsh evangelist. So it divided, and it divided before Newton was even exposed to any of those kinds of things. And so it's, if we want full disclosure, I'm on the Whitefield side. Okay, but I do want to say that my great grandfather was a Free Methodist licensed preacher in the Kingston area 100 years ago. So, and I looked for an hour trying to find the certificate that I have of where it's signed, where he is an official person. So I thought I'd bring that in case you tried to throw me out. But, okay, here we go. Does it work? No. Okay, at the top, I've given you a summary of some details of Newton's life. Where he was born in London, England, 1725, age 6. He was an only child. Age 6, his mother died. Ages 11 to 17, he was on the sea with his father, who was a captain of a merchant marine ship in the Mediterranean. 17 to 18, he was press ganged, or as we learned this morning, he was impressed. He was chosen, fixed. He had to change his employment. He was forced to serve the Navy. That was a legal way of getting recruits on your Navy ship. In ages 19 to 29, he was involved in the slave trade. And during that time, he made 4 trips. Then he was converted. Sort of the beginning of his conversion occurred when he was 22 in a storm in the Atlantic off Newfoundland on the way back. He would write later on that he thought his conversion didn't really get clear until about 6 months later. But this was it was in a storm, and he cried out to God. That was this crisis moment. After that, he made 4 trips on slave ships, and 3 as a captain. He was married to a girl called Mary, his childhood sweetheart, at least teenage anyway. He called her Polly. That was his nickname for her. Age 29, he had epileptic seizure. He had to quit the sea. So he didn't quit the sea because he was tired of the slave trade. He quit the sea because of a health issue. He was unemployed for 10 months. And, I'll get right into the story now as I follow along in the paper. Now, what I'm going to be presenting to you is, most of it is brand new. Not that it's out of my head, but... 10 years ago, I found or located the missing middle diary of John Newton. There were 3 that he wrote over his lifespan, and the middle one went missing about 1860. And so I found it providentially about 10 years ago, and I've always wanted to publish something from it. So I started work on that, and when I did, I thought, well, now he says a lot about Wesley in there. But I thought to give background a look at the first diary, and there he talks about his, when he first met Whitfield. So that's how that book emerged. And now I'm 3/4 of the way through working on my manuscript for the relationship of Newton to John Wesley. It's largely an untold story, although some of his letters have been analyzed, but a lot of material was unknown because they didn't have this diary. So I was privileged to find it, and I'm excited to share it with you, and particularly as it's coming from John Newton, who, as I say, had adopted a Calvinistic position. All right. During his 10 months of unemployment, he and his wife, Polly, moved to the London area. By this time, the Methodist movement had divided into two branches, and I've already mentioned that. And it was in London, largely through his interaction with Calvinistic pastors and hearing the powerful preaching of Whitfield, that he became a committed evangelical Calvinist, as opposed to a higher Calvinist. Through his former employer, he obtained an important position in the customs office, customs department in the Liverpool Harbor. So he moved back to Liverpool, which was the main harbor there. And there, as he had before, he attended the Anglican churches in the town, especially for the sacrament, because it was usually expected, at times required, that you would receive the sacrament at the Anglican or Episcopal or Church of England church if you're going to work in the government. It was basically a requirement that way. But he also started to attend for the first time a Calvinistic Baptist church since he had become a Calvinist. A few weeks later, though, Whitfield came to town for the very first official time. And there he had the privilege of hearing Whitfield preach 9 times, and that's all included there in the book. After Whitfield's visit, in addition to attending the Anglican churches, there are 3 or 4 in the town, and the 1 Baptist churches, which was sort of a high Calvinist hypertype, he began to also attend a 2nd Baptist church that was recommended by Whitfield. He thought the other one was more inclined, was closer to Whitfield's position. And then he also started to attend for the first time, generally on a regular basis, the Methodist meeting house where Whitfield had preached 9 times. Over the next 4 months, though, he became increasingly concerned about the low spiritual condition in the town and its churches. Therefore, he wrote to Whitfield and pled for him to return. And if Whitfield could not come, he asked him to send some of his preachers. And if they could not come, he asked him to pass on the request to John Wesley to send some of his preachers to strengthen the Methodist congregation that was in serious disruption and decline in the town. Even Wesley had noticed that 2 years prior on his visit to the town, where he made the comment that those in the Methodist meeting house were, quote, dear lovers of controversy, end of quote. In Newton's letter to Whitfield, he expressed that he was quite pained over the poor quality of preachers and preaching at the meeting house. He lamented, "They have the best house in the place, yet they will neither allow any but their own people to preach in it, nor will they keep it supplied themselves." So he asked Whitfield to pass on the request to Wesley. Set before him, that's Wesley, the importance of this great town and urge him to send such preachers here, if none may be omitted, but of his own sending, as have skill to divide the word of truth in a lively, affecting manner, and may dwell upon the great essentials of the gospel in the first place, to inform the people of the truths in which all renewed Christians agree, before they puzzle them with the points in which they differ. The following year, and we're not too sure whether Whitfield ever got passed on the request, but anyway, a year or so later, Wesley came to town. So this was the first time that Newton had the opportunity of hearing Wesley. He had read something of Wesley, but had never heard him. His first time as a Calvinist to hear John Wesley. And during Newton's time there, Wesley came on five different occasions. And I give the listing of the there in on the sheet. Now, it's I find very interesting that if you look in the handout, now what's in the box? This is extracted from this many volume set of the works of John Wesley. This is the most recent one. These are letters, but the earlier volumes, volume 21, 22, 23, I think, they have his journal. And so what's in the box is what you have in Wesley's journal. Where you see the dots, I simply eliminated other information about that event. But you'll notice there that that he leaves many things out. Well, you didn't know they were left out until you read Newton's diary. So I think Newton's diary adds a wonderful way of looking at what was going on at the same time. So he gives, and now sort of, I'm not too sure why Wesley included what he did and why he left some things out. He gives that curious interview on Thursday of the 28th about this person who beat his wife. I'm not too sure why he included that. Is he saying that that's an aberration or what? But it's an unusual, but it is. Of course, I'm being sarcastic here, but it's helpful that at least he spotted that and raised it. But I find it interesting that there are many things that he doesn't mention. He only mentions Newton once, and this is later on. During his first visit, Wesley does not mention meeting Newton, but Newton mentions meeting him. On Wednesday, Wesley had dinner with John and his wife. And on Friday, Wesley and Peter Whitfield, he's mentioned there, he's a Hebrew scholar, spent the afternoon with him. And Newton commented that it was a pleasant opportunity. In fact, Wesley stayed till 7 in the evening and left to preach at 8 o'clock. The next day, Newton says he spent an hour or two with Mr. Wesley. And these were times, even the first visit to the town, where there's a beginning of friendship between the two of them. And on the Sunday, which is not mentioned here in the box, Wesley also went to one of the other Anglican churches in the town. And on that occasion, Newton went with him. So these are little bits and pieces of things that he did that are not recorded in his journal. Now, what I find very interesting and helpful is that he gives significant detail about the preaching of Wesley. If you look at the handout there, you'll see that I think it's 11-day visit, the number of times he preached. He was averaging, I think it was two a day. And the advantage of this is that Newton tells us on what Wesley preached. And these are not included in any of the published sermons. One might be the one on perfection, but it's quite different. You can imagine, he's a traveling preacher, and that's how it went. But I think it's quite fascinating that all this is included. And now all of his preaching, at least when he was in Liverpool, was in the meeting house. When Whitfield came, he preached in the meeting house, plus out in the big park where 2,000 people had gathered. And during the five mission trips, Newton heard Wesley preach at least 58 times, and he took careful notes, and he gives the text and the content, sometimes the outline, of 53. And so during this first visit, you can see that he preached 20 times. Now in the handout, the dark copy, sorry that it's so dark, but this is a photocopy of 3/4 of the page of Newton's diary. You notice that it's just packed. He's trying to save paper, and it just flows right on. flows together. And so that's and just amazing that he hears this sermon and goes home and records this thing. It's quite phenomenal. He really did have power of observation and excellent, excellent memory. And so what you see on the, this is an extract now of that page, and that's the sermon. I've broken it up a little bit so you can see more clearly the divisions and how it goes. So I'm quite thrilled with the opportunity of sharing that in a published form. And you notice what he says at the bottom of that event. He says he concluded with a close and lively application both to the saints and sinners. But then he said, and I put in italics, sort of the comments, his own personal reflections. He says, I went too much under the power of prejudice and was justly punished with a hard, unfeeling heart. He did pretty well to remember what he did. But the discourse was very excellent, and I desire thankfully and carefully to lay hold of every opportunity of hearing him. So it's really quite something that way. I'll just quickly mention a couple other comments. As the times went on, they grew closer and closer, and the final. Now, it doesn't mean that he agreed with everything Wesley was saying on the 14th sermon. This was on justification. Newton wrote, "Here indeed we differed." Of sermon 19. He said, it was in my judgment a good, suitable discourse, though perhaps he carried the notion of falling away farther than it is necessary to agree with him. All right? So what you're getting here, he's not writing down in a dictation. All right? He's a listener who's processing it, so you're getting through his eyes and ears. All right? It's not a dictation. But it's amazing how clearly he follows it, and then he will note, well, this is, I differed here, and he made those, he was able to distinguish between what he was hearing and his own impression of it at different times.
Grant, do you have any sense of whether he might have had some kind of a little notebook?
They don't really know. He did know shorthand, so he possibly did a little bit, but they didn't have, laptops and things like this. Yeah, they had a little booklet that this is probably what he did. He does, on a couple occasions, he says, I was so busy today, I couldn't really get it down until now, and so I'll just summarize. So he was being very as careful as he could to remember the actual thing. And at the end of the final sermon that week, he says, Wesley kept the best wine till last. And as he left town, Newton declared, Now I desire to bless God on his behalf that I have seen him and heard him. The word, the preached word, has, I hope, done me good by his ministry, and the remaining power of bigotry in me has received a blow, which I would hope will keep it low hereafter. And he had learned a powerful lesson. He says, I would hope that since the Lord has taken so gracious and a favorable way to correct my ignorance and presumption, I shall no more presume to censure and judge without hearing, or dare confine the Spirit of the Lord to those only who tally in all things with my sentiments. So, and that was characteristic of his whole life. And I want us to give a bit of time for some questions here, so I'm going to skip a fair bit. There was a fascinating piece. At one time they were traveling, and Newton was walking along with Wesley and two of the other itinerants to make a pastoral visit. And on the way, Wesley was reading letters that he had received. Some of them talked about the current events of the day, and there were, earthquakes and things like this, and there's sort of signs of the times talk and all of that. And this is the Newton's diary. Mr. Wesley read a letter he received but yesterday from London. giving an account of the words of a young man who has been for some a young woman who has been for some time in an extraordinary way. The purport or the substance of her message is that woe is beginning, or in a manner begun. She said there are many papists in England who are contriving a massacre, but will not be able to effect anything till after the king's death. She further said that the time of Mr. Wesley's removal is at hand, that it will be by suffering, and that very probably he will return to London no more. But of this she's not positive. When Newton and his itinerant sailed off to Dublin at the end of that time, Newton writes, "I felt something sorrowful, chiefly for the message from London, which, if it should prove true, makes me fear I shall see his face no more." So I have a lot of other quotes from those events, but I want to get to maybe something that you might be very interested in. And that is exactly how they related. After all these different visits and interaction with him, they continued to correspond. We have five letters of Newton and five letters of Whitfield. Now they're not overlapping, so you're not getting an interchange. There are gaps, so you sort of have to figure that out. But in these letters, two differences emerged, and each one of them, each side pressed for their own position. Newton defended the Calvinistic view of imputed righteousness, that one is declared righteous as a declaration, whereas Wesley saw this as is dangerous, because he was convinced it would lead to careless living. If you're totally right with God, well, there won't be any motivation. The other doctrine was the doctrine of perfection. Wesley pressed for instantaneous and at times entire sanctification, whereas Newton saw sanctification as gradual and progressive. Though it's interesting that earlier, because of his interaction with the Methodist, or let's call him the Wesleyan Methodist, he didn't like the idea of perfectionism, and then he began to think, well, might be something to this. So this is what he writes. This is 1762. "About this time I begin to alter my sentiments in some measure about a point much disputed, the doctrine of perfection. Indeed, I cannot approve of the explications and pretensions some have given, nor do I think perfection, strictly speaking, attainable in this mortal state or compatible with it. But I begin to think that some who are reproached and misunderstood upon this account do indeed experience much power and peace beyond what I've known. And I believe I've done wrong to limit the Lord. And instead of disputing now, I would turn to him and by earnest prayer entreat him to set me at liberty also and give me a larger measure of what his promises encourage me to expect." So he did that. Though he came back 3 or 4 months later, he had been away, and he had reversed his opinion. He says, and he wrote this change of opinion. He went back to the diary, the note in the margin, not much room in the margin, 4 months earlier, and he wrote in the margin these words in bold print. "Upon further reflection and observation," that's a key piece here, "I must fear that what there is good in this matter is mixed with much evil. Enthusiasm is breaking in like a flood." Now, those of you who understood that, there was that happening also down in the London area. And he never forgot that. He never forgot what he saw, because he was living in the towns. And so 25 years later, he says there was a woman, he remembers way back, "there was a woman in Liverpool when I lived there who was so perfect that she declared she tried to sin but could not. About the year 1773, this strange doctrine spread like wildfire in Mr. Wesley's societies, and there are several persons improved or set upon it. They said," he gives some examples, "they said that death was the wages of sin, but as they were perfect, freed from sin, they took it into their heads that they would never die." He says, "Others I have known No, this is not just he's heard about. He probably heard about what was going on in the London. He says, others I have known who thought themselves too good to repeat the Lord's Prayer. Forgive us our trespasses. For they supposed they had no trespasses to be forgiven. Yes, and some thought themselves too perfect to need intercession of Christ. So that was the extremes that he was experiencing, and that's what he says. And there are a couple other examples of that, but I want to just end with a couple points here. Newton, though he disagreed with Wesley on a couple of those theological issues, he was also quick to defend the Wesley and the Methodist. He writes to a fellow Calvinist, a pastor, "There is much to be lamented." He's speaking as a Calvinist here. "There is much to be lamented in Mr. Wesley's scheme. But he is not an enemy of the gospel." I mean, some were saying it. "Though very dark with respect to some glorious truths." He meant glorious Calvinistic truths, right? "I have, however, the most satisfactory evidence that the Lord works by him and his brethren. And in the midst of all the chaff of opinions which he too earnestly contends for, he has a sincere aim to the glory of God and the good of souls. Some of his preachers and people I know to be excellent persons, though there are too many ranked under his banner who do him little honor, but rather cause the ways of truth to be evil spoken of." Right. He didn't discount everybody, but he's able to separate. And even Wesley recognized that Newton had a healer of breaches. That's how he described Newton. And in fact, on one occasion, he asked Newton to intervene and to speak to those people in the ways that you can to those people that I don't have access to. And that was very helpful. And at the same time, though, he could challenge his own Calvinist people. This is what he said to John Ryland, and that's the book over there. Ryland had, he's only 18, and he published a 200 or so page book of poems. Poems, they were long, long deals, and they're mostly anti-Arminian stuff, all right? And he was coming from a high Calvinist type of home. But Newton was sort of a father figure to this young lad and felt, oh, I don't like what I read here. And so he took the risk and wrote to young Ryland, who was 18. Newton writes, "You say," this obviously was a quote from the, and was a quote from the preface, "I aimed to displease the Arminians," end of quote. "I had rather you had aimed to be useful to them than to displease them. There are many Arminians who are so," although he'd say only for lack of clearer light. "They fear the Lord and walk humbly before him. Now these should not be displeased by endeavoring to declare the truth, as you are, in terms the most offensive to them we can find, but rather we should seek out the softest and most winning way of encountering their prejudices. Otherwise, we make a parade and grow big with our sense of wisdom and importance, but we shall do little good. Our Lord, you know, taught that his disciples as they were able to bear it. He didn't aim to displease them." You will perhaps say, a humble Arminian? Surely that is impossible. He says, "I believe it's not more impossible to find a humbler Arminian than a proud, self-sufficient Calvinist." So he could, because he felt the doctrines, if you really understand it from a Calvinist perspective where God is doing most of the work, who are you to make it such, think you're so great? That's sort of the idea there. Let's end with the last two letters of Wesley to Newton to hear their perspective about each other. Wesley acknowledged to Newton that when they first met, they did not have full agreement doctrinally, but that did not hinder their fellow relationship because they each saw each other's brothers as brothers in Christ. He says this, quote, upon this ground of friendship, brothers in Christ, commence the acquaintance, perhaps I might say more the friendship, between you and me. We both knew there was a difference in our opinions and consequently in our expressions. But notwithstanding this, we tasted each other's spirits and often took sweet counsel together. The last letter, and I only found this last year, the last letter of Wesley to Newton, and that's probably going to be published in the next volume of letters. But enough of this disputing. All I desire is that we may walk according to the 13th chapter, 1 Corinthians, which surely difference of opinion need not hinder. Certainly, I believe some of your opinions to be just as wrong as you believe mine to be. But this does not prevent my loving you, yea, and seriously thinking of you, thinking you are much holier than me. All right? That's the last word I can find of Wesley to Newton. The last one is John Newton's comment about Wesley and the Wesleyans, and this is 25 years later. This is 1789. He writes this person who at later on in the letter, he does, you know, work on the issue of perfectionism, however we want to describe it. But at the beginning, this is how he introduces that letter. I hope I am no party man, a denominational man. I know there are many excellent people and some judicial, useful preachers in Mr. Wesley's connection. And I would, yea, and I do rejoice in the good which the Lord is pleased to do among them. Arminians, as they are called, who love the Savior, and by him walk according to the rule of the gospel, and overcome the world, are no less dear to me than Calvinists. And I find persons of this character agree with me in experience, though they differ from me in expression. Beautifully put, I think. And perhaps some hold some religious sentiments, which I deem erroneous. I mean, they both said that about each other. But whoever does the will of God, I would say the same is my brother and my sister and my mother. And that was written a year after John Newton served as one of the pallbearers to Charles Wesley, and that was after Charles Wesley's request. Okay, thank you.